His other credits other than this include The Simpsons, Futurama, Page Master, and Osmosis Jones. Please welcome Eddie Rosas.
Yeah.
Mr. Rassel, let's start out with you know, the genesis of this project. I mean, Ted Hughes was like one of the great poets in modern English literature, wrote this story in the 60s. And Pete Townsend of The Who, you know, had written music for it and was planning like sort of a rock opera sort of thing. How did you first find out about it?
Which one of these? All right.
Just that one. That's the one.
Check. All right.
My check.
When I had a project at Turner, which was for a very short time making animated features, and for me, you know, I used to call it Turner suspended animation because they would never, you know, they would kind of keep us just alive enough that, you know, we weren't gone. When Warner swallowed up Turner and the MGM library and the Atlanta Braves and Hanna-Barbera and Cartoon Network and all the stuff that was Turner, they got the caraway seed of the last 3 months of my contract. And they said, we don't want to make Ray Gun, but, you know, maybe there's something here that you like. And so they had like 45 projects in development, which meant really that none of them were being, you know, developed. But they had them, and they said, just pick like a few that you're interested in and then read them and see if there's anything there. And so I picked three, and the one that I liked was Iron Giant. But I had a very different idea for it than the, you know, they wanted to do the story. And the story in the book is the giant, it's in England, there's no specific time period. The giant, Hogarth has two parents, and about halfway through the book, it becomes a contest between the giant and this space bat the size of Australia, and they go back and forth. They have this competition going into the sun and back. And I kind of felt like the story was of the boy and the robot. So I came back to Warner Brothers. I know this is a long story. I'm feeling guilty because there's all these other people here. And very quickly, I came back and I said, I really like this story, but I have a different idea for it. And I said, what if a gun had a soul and didn't want to be a gun? And they liked that line, and so they gave me a meeting based on just that line. And I got into the meeting, and unbeknownst to them, I had written a whole alternate story, and I didn't tell any of them. I just started unloading it. So I said, they said, Brad has this idea, and you know, here, you know, and I went, what if a gun had a soul and didn't want to be a gun? Everybody nodded, and they were happy. And then I said, and it's set in 1950, and da-da-da-da. And all of a sudden, they were, like, getting really nervous. You know, there's this government guy, and there's you know, this beatnik character, and blah-blah-blah. And the guys that had gotten in the meeting thought I was, like, out of control because they didn't know about any of this. And suddenly, this rogue guy was going insane in the office in front of the heads of the studio. So they were, like, kind of panicking, but the heads of the studio were liking it. And so about halfway through the pitch, I saw one of them sort of like elbow the other one, and he started writing down what I was saying, you know, and so they liked it. They wanted to go ahead with it, and they wanted to make a deal with me, and then it sort of went from there. But I found out later that they had commissioned two guys to write treatments based on the notes of my pitch while I was negotiating with them. And one of them almost got screen credit, but I was smart enough to write it down and register it with the Writers Guild before I gave the pitch. So, they were actually on the books as a screen story by Joe, the guy who took the notes. And the notes were all wrong, by the way. A lot of it was screwed up, but anyway.
I noticed that there's a credit there for Ted Hughes, that he was a consultant. Did he like interact with you at all?
We talked to him on the phone. Allison Abate, the producer, had some conversations with him. We got a really nice letter from him. When I went to London to have dinner with Pete Townsend, Ted was supposed to join us, but he called in that night and said that he wasn't feeling well, and you know, maybe could we get together tomorrow, and unfortunately I was leaving the next day, and none of us knew that he was sick, but he was actually dying, and so, you know, he never saw the completed film, but he knew what we were doing with the story, and he actually liked it, and wrote this very nice letter, you know, to us, you know, so... No, I never got to meet him, but I came that close. Got to meet his family, though.
So now, one of the things I know a lot of people want to know about, and we can throw this at Mark and Steve, is the design of the giant. I mean, you know, I'm like, okay, I'm in my 50s now, and it's like, at one point, we're like, it was a toy I wanted to buy. Like, I wanted that toy. That's such a freaking cool toy. It's like, you know, where did you come up with that design? Or like, what was the genesis of the creation of the design of the giant?
Well, there have been designs before we got there to doing this, and they were more like, there was one that actually had lips and like a tongue, and it was all made out of metal, but it started to look a little deliberate to me, and I was sort of inspired by this train that was an Art Deco train, and somebody out there probably knows the name of it. I've forgotten. But I asked Joe Johnston to come up with designs based on that, because I knew he loved the 30s and that kind of style of design. And so he did some early drawings that were, you know, in the ballpark. And then Mark Whiting came in and took it, you know, to the next level and really added a lot of great details and got into much more of the nuance of it. And you know, Joe had a career as a director, and you know, he did it as a favor to me, you know, but he just did, you know, a few drawings. And then Mark really kind of hunkered down and pushed it through. And once it got to a certain point there, you know, and it started to, you know, we were actually heading towards animation, and Steve got involved in the design and kind of helped finesse it and bring it into 3D and make it so that it would work for animation. And it was really, Steve figured out how to shape, get expressions just by tilting the angles of things so that you know, his eyelids would function as both eyelids and brows. Mm-hmm. And if the lower one came up, it could sort of look like somebody doing that, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it was taking a very limited number of shapes, and by kind of bending them toward the camera in certain directions could change whether it was a smile or a frown. And that's, you know, there was a trick to that, and I think they all did a great job.
Did anyone jump anything into it?
Mr. White.
Sure. With regard to the evolution of the giant, Joe Johnson came up with these really great silhouettes, as I recall, literally just silhouettes with like a chisel marker. It's really super graphic, cool shapes, and he probably produced 8 or 10 of these things. And there was a couple that I kind of gravitated toward, and I remember doing a painting based on one of those. It was a really chunky version of the giant. look around in different directions. You know, some of our early artwork had like searchlights that moved around and stuff, and it was like there's no way to actually physically pull it off. It's like, I can't remember the theory about the lights behind frosted glass that could give direction and also could actually widen in a way.
Who came up with that wheel thing with the two little points like hitting it and shooting those?
That was Marcus and me. The Battle Mode Joint aesthetically, I did, and Mark had done the board and kind of come up with the ideas behind a lot of the weapons. Mark Whiting was already gone off the project, but so we got the Battle Mode Joint. And Brad couldn't get a hold of Joe Johnson because he was off directing, I think, October Sky. So we were left on our own. So the claw thing was actually the idea of the typewriter thing being hit was in the storyboard, and then I just worked out the look of it.
Cool. Yeah, Mark Andrews now is just completely Brave for Pixar. Right? He's doing that. So.
Cool.
Oh yeah, Covert John Connor. Wow. Cool. So okay. So I want to get a little bit too to like the storyboarding process. You know, while we got Steve there, because you guys also like you did a lot of writing on the boards. Like, you know, like you changed a lot of the story from the script level and stuff, like on the storyboards, like which is sort of like the older animation way of doing things.
Well, it was always interactive, although Brad was writing while we were boarding. He would always come to us with, okay, here's what I'm writing, you know, start drawing it. And actually, our head of story, Jeff Lynch, is out.
Oh, Jeff there?
Jeff Lynch, stand up!
Idea about putting like this autumn kind of feeling to things?
Yeah, we were looking at Thomas Hart Benton and a lot of reference from the 1950s and 40s as well, even going back to Sears magazines and catalogs just to see what the clothing was like in that era. Maine was the area that we were looking at, and I unfortunately didn't get to go on that trip back there, but
that's the cool thing about animations, when you get to go on trips. Cool.
Yeah, I missed out on that one, but it was really wonderful to try to achieve those colors. And I think that the great thing that I loved was the autumnal colors of the year, and then as it changes throughout the film, we're doing so many different changes from daytime to nighttime to dusk, and all these beautiful colors. That by the time you get to the point where the giant is turning into the gun, all the color has been zapped out of the film to white, and I just love that direction that you gave to us to do that.
And then just line up like this out.
Yeah, Lou definitely did that great moment when the giant shoots the gun and the whole scene turns from red to green. It was really beautiful. I just loved working with Brad to do this color.
into, let's get Eli while Eli's here. So talk a little bit about you know, I mean, you talked a bit earlier about some of the stuff that Brad had you doing on the production and everything. And like, how did you like first find out about the project?
You know, it was actually, I remember it very clearly, of all the auditions in all the corners of this town that I had driven to, I remember this one very clearly because it was, I was filming something else. It was at 5 o'clock or 5:30. It was a last minute thing. I was so close to just blowing it off. So close to saying, sure that
you know, there was a little wobbliness in the line, or just trying to really capture and make sure that it looked like pencil work when it was done. And then marrying that all together with camera moves. So we could, and I'll let Brad talk about this as an animator, but we worked to bring together the same camera mechanics that we would finally see on film, that the 2D artists would, that when they're doing their composite work, we see exactly the same thing as all the 3D artists. So it's all married together.
So that looks like a good lead-in, Brad. So, Brad, you want to talk about the other Brad, about the creation of 3D animation?
I was lucky enough. This is one of my first films that I worked on. It was actually my second film, but I claim it to be my first film. We won't talk about the first one, but I was really lucky to be part of this, and I think on the first film, Tad kind of gave me a chance to step up from being just a normal CG generalist to really stepping over into character animation. And when I first got onto it, you know, it took, I think Brad and the story crew, we came onto the film and they were still trying to work out stories, so there's a lot of downtime in the beginning. And I think Steve and I talked about, you know, what we can do to help keep people busy. So Steve had actually done the first, I think, kind of more stiff, one of the walk cycles that you see, in the beginning of the film. And then I went down, being young and stupid, I went down into the story department and found this whole boarded sequence in the end of the movie that I think actually changed quite a bit by the time it was all said and done. But it was a whole scene where the giant went out into traffic and he was trying not to step on cars. So I basically took that scene and started animating a run cycle with one of my compatriots sitting in the back there, Richard Bainham. Oscar-winning
Avatar.
Anyway, I started working on this run cycle, and Richie helped me kind of get it there. And then I just started like basically animating shots from the end of the movie. So because we started doing that, Steve, I appreciate it, gave me the whole kind of battle or the whole action sequence. Back with the missile, and he basically runs through the town, so all those shots I got to do because I had done the run cycle. So anyway, that's
let's deal in Eddie here. So Eddie, so you were part of a trio and of like young artists, like right out of Cal Arts stuff, and getting your first character animation. So what was that like?
It was pretty unique. I'm up here representing basically a small group of students that was given amazing opportunity. Myself and three others were basically in the right place at the right time, is how I like to look at it. It was Peter Song, who's now co-directing up at Pixar.
Peter was also the model for the little kid and Up and everything, the little boys character.
Yeah, and the voice of the deal.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and Shane Brigmore, who's in the audience somewhere. Shane's won an Annie Award for character design on Coraline, and amongst other things. And there was also Andy Schuler, who is now a storyboard artist over at DreamWorks. But it was between our junior and senior year at CalArts when Brad and Tony Fagili came up, and they're both former graduates of the program, so they had that connection. But they came up there to look at portfolios, and at the time we knew of Brad from Family Dog and The Simpsons, and also as a director of Ray Gun, which we were all really excited about at school. And we also knew he had the reputation of being kind of the rebel of animation, which we thought was really cool. So we kind of, you know, viewed him as the Han Solo of the industry. And, you know, when we met Brad, you know, Tony Fucili was by his side, you know, every single time we saw him. So Tony was basically the Chewbacca of the group. So it was a pretty funny duo. So after his whole process, he selected the four of us from a group of other students, and we were just so grateful to be brought onto the project. And for Brad, it was like, they took us under their wing, both Brad and Tony, and I think for Brad, it was more of a pay it forward type of deal with what Milk Hall did with him early on in his career. So we were just, you know, we were eternally grateful for the opportunity that he gave us.
Before I throw this open to, like we can take a question or two from the audience, Brad, I was just wondering that, like, in retrospect, because now you've done a couple of films since this film, what keeps bringing you back to this one?
I think that just the feeling of, you know, wow, I got a film and I may never get another one, so let's make this one count. I mean, that was kind of my feeling was, you know, this kind of happened from a series of flukes, and if there's probably about 10 different things that if they didn't just go in exactly that combination, it's like a mushroom spore or something, you know. You can't really grow mushrooms, they just sort of happen, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And this was an odd combination, and I was just like, you know, quick, let's make a movie before they find out, you know. So that was my feeling, and that feeling never quite leaves me, you know.
Yeah, that's cool. I mean, but what I was loving about this film too was that I remember a guy who was an AD for Bakshi used to say, "Listen, do you see the money on the screen? You hear about the budgets, it's the money on the screen." And sometimes you'll see like a $200 million movie or something, and you're like, you know, this, you see every penny on the screen. I mean, you see like it's really, really well done.
Thanks. There's a lot of baling wire and chewing gum there. Too close.
Yeah. So let's go. The MTV people are pushing. So let's see. Does anybody have a question? Do you want to throw a question out there? And everything. Let me get you. You were the first one in the gray shirt. Oh yeah. You got the music. You about Michael Kamen.
Yeah. Well, music, I mean, this is like 101, but music is really key, and it's sort of like open heart surgery at the end of the movie, because it's late in the game, but a good score can absolutely make a film, and a bad score can just damage it just unbelievably, and it's all at the last bit when everything is done. So I was really lucky to get Michael Kamen, who lived in England, even though he was an American, and so he kind of was familiar with the material, and he knew a lot of those guys because he played with Metallica. He did conducted orchestras with Metallica, and he knew Eric Clapton and Pete Townsend and all those guys. But he was kind of an intellectual guy and sort of a bohemian. It was unbelievably great to hang out with, and we recorded the music for Iron Giant in Prague. So I got to hang out with Michael Kamen and a lot of his guys in Prague, which was just cool upon cool. Cool times cool. And, you know, he was just a really great guy. I was really sad, you know, when he died. But I'm really, really happy I found Michael Giacchino, because I have a great relationship with him, and you know, he's come through every single time. But Michael's score is fantastic. Both Michaels.
Okay, we got one more. So how about that fellow back there with the hand up in the orange or red?
Can see the color. Do you foresee working on any other traditionally animated films in the future?
Do you foresee working on any other traditionally animated hand-drawn features?
Yeah, I would like to. I mean, I think it's really cool, and I feel like nobody's really putting the big bucks into it now, and you know, when it's really done well, I think it has its own look that's very unique and not replicatable any other way. I mean, I also feel that way about Nick Park's work. You know, I hope he never discovers a computer, you know, because, and I love computer films. Obviously, I've made two of them, and you know, would absolutely welcome an opportunity to work that way again. It's just that all of these processes have their own feeling, and you can't get it any other way. I mean, Henry Selick's films, it seems like you ought to be able to replicate them in the computer, but you can't. There's something that's ineffable about touching something and moving it. And Henry's making a film in San Francisco right now, and it's great that it's stop motion. And you know, I just think all of these things are as, you know, as different and as valuable as jazz is to classical, but it's all great. And I don't think that there's enough hand-drawn films being done now. I'd love to see more. It's dead. It's done with. It's over. And they were going to close it down at CalArts. They were going to have the animation program, but it's all going to be CG. And Ed Catmull, bless his heart, came down there and said, "Are you crazy?" He said, "A hand-drawn animation is the foundation of all animation, and you know, people can learn the box, which is what they call the computer. But you know, the skills that you learn from doing hand-drawn can be applied in any direction." And it was ironic because the only reason they listened to him was because he was a computer guy. But you know, Ed Catmull is, you know, largely responsible, and John Lasseter, for keeping hand-drawn animation alive at CalArts.
So, as we wrap up, we have to get away from the MTV people, but before we give them a big round of applause, I'd like anybody who worked on Iron Giant, come on up here. You don't have to come up on stage, you can be out front down here, but let's just see like how much of the crew is here, and give them a hand.